Okay, my name's Tim Jones and I'm conducting this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust and the One Another Project in Trafalgar Square, London. It's the 19th of August 2009 and the time is just coming up to 20 past 1pm. If I could ask you to tell us your name, age and where you come from, please.
Okay, I'm Margaret Squires and I'm 70 and I come from St Andrews, Scotland.
Thank you. Can you tell us when it was you found out about the One Another Project?
I think some in May, probably, whenever it appeared in The Guardian.
And what was it that inspired you to put your name forward?
Well, I thought I'd like the idea of an inclusive portrait of Britain being painted, and I thought that it's a shame that pensioners aren't going to volunteer because pensioners by and large get vertigo. And then I thought, hang on, I'm a pensioner and I go hill walking, so I don't get vertigo by and large, so I'll volunteer. And that's what happened.
So tell us more about then the portrait of the UK. What is it that you find particularly appealing about the project?
Just that random people, it won't be random people, because it'll be random people who don't mind showing off, are going to be included. And I just think that that's an excellent idea. I can't really add to that.
So tell us about your background then. What is it that you do for a living, did for a living? What do you do in your spare
right.
time?
Right. I was for 37 years a second-hand bookseller. I started a stall in the market and it expanded to be a bookshop, and I gradually bought out all my business partners, and towards the end I was running it by myself with the help of about 7 staff. And being in St Andrews, we specialised in golf books, and it became known as the, in some of the golf magazines I've heard it quoted as probably the best golf bookshop in the world, so I'm quite proud of that. But really I would have preferred it to be about mountains, because that's my pet love, but I don't think I would have been able to persuade myself to part with the mountain books, because whenever mountain books came through, I often took them home and kept them. And so I was always very pleased when mountaineers came in and had a look in the mountain section and we could swap notes. And I used to have the shop arranged by topic, so all the high subjects were high up and all the low subjects were low down. So I had birds up high and astronomy up high and UFOs up high and religion down low and gardening down low and archaeology down low, on the assumption that people who wanted those books would be able to adopt that sort of posture. But mountaineers were a bit of a problem, because although they had a ladder to climb up, so many of them came in that I had to move their books to a middle-sized shelf so they could have a look at them, unless it was just that their mountaineering skills didn't translate to ladder climbing, I'm not sure. So that's what I did in my working life. In my spare time, I was a political activist for a long time. Labour Party isn't very strong in North East Fife. It tends, Min Campbell is the MP there now. I was a Labour Party political activist, and I carried on until 2003 in the Iraq War, where I marched against the war in Glasgow, and it had no effect whatsoever. Maybe we were extremely naive to think it might ever have an effect. And so I packed in my membership. And so I have more time for mountain climbing. I'm sorry to miss the companionship that belonged to a political party provided, but most of us have gone our own way because we have just fed up with Labour, I'm afraid. Other spare time. I did, for a while, run the health council in Fife, which, that's the consumer's input into the health service. We had to represent the patient's interests. And I chaired that for 4 years, but it really ate my life. It became far more business-like. They wanted us to write business plans to what we were going to do the following year, how many people we were going to interview, how many complaints we were going to take up. Well, you never know how many complaints you're going to take up. It depends how bad they are. And so I did it for 4 years, and then I packed that one in. And I have, four grandchildren who tend to keep me busy. They're great. And so what else do I do in my spare time? I occasionally go to a local theatre. I must say I'm not an out-and-out arts type person. When I was in business, I used to sponsor Stanza, which is the St Andrews Poetry Festival. And it's now become really Scotland-wide. It's become the best poetry festival in Scotland. And one of the people who worked in my shop was artist director of that for a while, and that's why she wanted a bookshop job, because she wanted just enough money to enable her to do artistic directing in her spare time. And this is what I found with my employees. We all still keep in touch and meet once a month, that part-time people by and large have other things of great interest in their life or great need. One had an autistic daughter, and that's why she wanted to be part-time. One had a dying husband, and that's why she wanted to be part-time. And her hours increased latterly. But I'm really very keen on women having portfolio careers and being able to manage their own lives as much as possible, not being forced into the 9-to-5 and therefore having to neglect their children. This is probably really very old-fashioned, and 9-to-5 mothers, or 9-to-6, 7, 8, 9, 10, this whole atmosphere of presenteeism today would come down on me like a ton of bricks, but kids aren't little for long, and it's nice to have sight of them when they're little.
So tell us more about, to start with,
Mountains. Where did that start? My husband's very keen. It was a case of, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. When we first went on a mountain holiday, it wasn't even mountains, it was in Shropshire, and my husband looked back and saw me crawling up a 1 in 10 slope on grass and thought, my God, what have I got myself allied? But we did more, and I got keener and keener, and eventually I started Munro bagging. Munros are mountains over 3,000 feet in Scotland, and there's 284 of them. And when my husband first went up to Scotland, I think only 10 people had done them, and now there's over 5,000 have done them. And I'm very proud of being Munroist number 311. And everyone's Munro round is overshadowed by the awful thought of the Inaccessible Pinnacle. It's the only hill in the whole round that you actually need to go up on a rope, or at least come down on a rope, because you go up the slopey side, and then other people are wanting to come up the slopey side, and there is no way that you would want to go down the slopey side, because it is at such an angle. So you then have to abseil off the non-slopey side, and I never thought I would do that, but it was my husband's last mountain of his Munros, so we went and we got a guide, and the guide was fantastic. I think he realised I was nervous and just bustled me on, and I was going to think about whether or not I was going to do the Inaccessible Pinnacle, and he just didn't leave me time to think. He said, here you are, step in here, you go up the pinnacle and abseil off. And we had learned to abseil off a wooden tower, so that was okay. And after that, I only had about 60 to do, so I thought, right, I will, I'll finish them. And it was a great feeling to finish them. But then you look around and think, what do I do next? And of course, there's always an answer to that, which is you climb the Corbie, which is the mountains between 2,500 and 3,000. And they are tougher. You wouldn't believe that, but not so many people have been. There aren't any beaten tracks on some of them. They're some miles away from anywhere. And like the Inaccessible Pinnacle, there is the dreaded prospect of the cobbler, which I still haven't done, and where you have to go up and thread your way through a hole in the rock and then scramble your way somehow up a ledge over a precipice and then onto the top. And I'm down to 20 to go, and the cobbler is rearing its ugly head closer and closer as I get there. It's almost as frightening as the thought of doing a plinth. We've been abroad a lot as well. Got up to base camp in Everest, and that was just a stomp up. It's not technical. And the mountains there, around there, are just fantastic. You look across and you can see Amadablam, and you can see the perpetual, or what seems like perpetual, wind coming off Everest with the plume of snow, and it's probably going 50 or 60 miles an hour. And I looked at that and thought, well, bang goes my ambition of ever being the first granny on Everest. I just couldn't do it. So, it was a fleeting ambition for a while. I don't know, it would be nice to see it from the Tibetan side. I once cleared the fascinating part about being a second-hand bookseller is you get to see a snapshot of people through their books. And I once cleared the books belonging to the consul, the last British consul in Tibet, whose name is Hugh Richardson. And he actually asked the Dalai Lama to come and play golf with him in St. Andrews. And he was a friend of the Dalai Lama's, and he was a friend of Heinrich Harrer, of 7 years in Tibet fame. And when I went to clear Hugh's house, he said, please don't let my name appear in my books, because I don't want people to know I'm selling them off. He was funding his sick wife. She was demented, and he moved. I cleared three times, in fact, when he moved from a huge house to a medium-sized house to a tiny house, and then he moved into a retirement flat. But most of his Tibet books went to the university. But I got from him this book, Return to Tibet by Heinrich Harrer, in which he'd written to Hugh from Heine in recollection of 7 happy years in Tibet. And I looked at that and I thought, I can't cut that out and sell it. So I've still got it. I don't know what anyone will do with it. Well, my son will probably have it when I've finished with it. He's keen on mountains, so he'll probably take our mountain books. But I've come to a full stop on that particular strand.
Thank you. Tell us about books then. How did you get into books?
Into second-hand books. Well, I suppose all students have to read books. And my husband's an academic. He was always involved with books. And I was a nose in a book child. I was not an outdoors child. I was a stick your nose in a book child. And so when we went to St. Andrews, there weren't very many jobs for academic wives to do. You could teach, but you needed a Scottish qualification, so that was an extra time off. And by then I'd got a young child. And I'd taken the young child, age 3, to look at the ducks, and she had gone into a total tantrum and was screaming and was totally rigid because she wanted to bring a duck home and I wouldn't let her. And I carried her stiff like a board under my arms back home, and the telephone rang. And I couldn't get at the telephone because the telephone was in a box in which I put it to stop her dialing America at random. And so eventually the phone rang again when I stood out of a box, and it was somebody I vaguely knew, who was a wife of a colleague of my husband's. And she said, do you know anybody who can drive? Because a friend and I are thinking of setting up a second-hand bookshop in St. Andrew's Market, but we need somebody who can drive to take us on the books to market. And so I said, yes, me. Meanwhile, 3-year-old was sitting, poor thing, sobbing on the stairs, and I was saying, be quiet, I want to hear what this is all about. And she was said, I'll be quiet if you get me a hanky. And her aunties had given her a whole set of hankies, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And so I grabbed a hanky and flung it at her. And she said, what day is it? And I said, it's Wednesday. And she said, this is my Saturday hanky. And I thought, I will kill this child if I don't get out of the house. And much as you love them, you do get these moments from time to time. And so to start with, we had a a bookstall in the market, and we put an ad in the paper and that we were in the market for books, and went and bought books, and we went to auctions, and I did very little. I was the sort of buffer between the two other partners, and I did the accounts, because on day one we came back and we emptied out this big leather pouch of money we'd accumulated, and they said, "What next?" And I said, "Well, one day the taxman might want to know about this. I think we ought to count it." So I became the accountant. And one by one, my partner's husbands got jobs elsewhere. And we'd by then got a shop, again, purely by luck, because this empty shop was run by a trust, and the trustees were all merchants in town. And they, none of them wanted to tread on their friends' feet by putting in someone who might compete with them. And they thought, well, three ladies playing at shops, probably quite a good idea, won't last long anyway. And after a while, we realised the trust had gathered together all the shops just surrounding that and were intending selling the whole lot to a supermarket, which was, to our minds, utterly ridiculous. We were only 40 yards from a historical site in St Andrews, which is the old stone archway, which only lets one car at a time through. And there's no parking for this supermarket, so we've raised the town against them. And we didn't win because they turned us out, but they got their didn't get their planning permission, so we drew. And at that time they turned us out. There weren't any more shops to rent, but there was one to buy, which was down Golf Place, which was how the golf came into it, because we were smack bang near the golf course, only a 5-iron shot from the 18th green. And of course golf wasn't in the 70s all that huge, but by the time the Americans had come over and played in our Open and it had become commercial, golf became massively huge. And by the time of the Millennium Open, during the Open, I think I took 14 times as much in 1 week as I did in my best normal week. And the other thing I really liked about secondhand bookselling, which I forgot to say, is we recycled all the students' texts to them, so they came in May and sold us their books, which was bad news for me because it meant I was stapled to the seat in the shop for the entire best hill walking time. So now I'm retired, I can do May and June and don't have to, well, I do still battle the midges in June and July and August, but May, June are the fantastic walking times in Scotland. So I liked the idea that I was recycling things. I think I was green before green. And I've always liked the idea of not wasting and recycling, and this seemed as good a way as any of doing it. But it was very strange because one day you were in the student thing and you were chatting to students about their courses, and even exam panic, somebody would come in and say, "Have you got a copy of Wuthering Heights? Sorry, we sold the last yesterday. Can you tell me the story? Because I've got an exam tomorrow." And very, very tempted to say, well, it's about a young orphan boy who asks for more. But I can't tell him that, poor chap. He will fail his exam, not just get a third. And then the next, we were getting up and bowing to Japanese. And Japanese people would come in. We twice sold every single golf book in the shop to a Japanese gentleman. Every single golf book. And then towards the Open, another Japanese gentleman came in and said, "How much if I buy every golf book in your shop?" And I said, "Well, these days I'm afraid you're looking at something like 7,000. And it's only 7,000 because I don't stock the really expensive antiquarian books. Someone else does that. I'm too scared of someone shoving £40,000 worth up the jumper and running. So I only ever, I stopped at 500. So then, realising that that was possibly a little beyond him, he said, "What is the most expensive golf book you have in the shop?" And this was, I think, because he brought in friends and decided he wanted to gain a little bit of kudos, so he bought, without looking at it, without knowing anything about it, the most expensive golf book in the shop, which was a book about golf course architecture. Extremely scarce, but unless you're a golf course architect, you probably, or a golf collector, you probably don't want it.
So how does it feel being being in charge, being responsible for this such a successful business?
Well, it's very sad because it went. This is the nature of second-hand bookshops in modern age, partly because of the internet, partly because of charity shops setting up. I don't want to do down charity shops. They do a great job. But it's just the nature of life now that second-hand booksellers are struggling. Second-hand bookshops are struggling. They can go online and do a very nice thing out of that. If I was setting up today, I think I would find a nice charity who wanted my profits, and I would pay myself a nice wage to run the shop for them and get some honest person to audit the accounts, and that would be that. Because to Oxfam, they get 14 pence in every pound for every book buy there, which isn't a lot. The rest goes on wages, admin, and all the rest of it. So I couldn't sell it as a going concern, because since the Millennium Open, it's a gradually going downhill concern. And I could have run it for another 5 years and it would have been okay, but we'd have started not being able to pay the wages. And so I went out in a bang, had a big closing down sale, decided I couldn't afford to advertise it, so I pushed out three of my bikes every day to places where people went, like a post office, which itself was under threat, Tesco, which is not under threat, which booksellers have a bone to pick with Tesco for taking Harry Potter away from them. I had a tremendous closing down sale, and I'm still gradually getting rid of stuff online. I still haven't found a customer for my Pisgah View of Palestine, 16-something. Of course, a couple of the plates are missing, and people always want those particular plates. And you look at Palestine as it was envisaged to be in 16-something, you think, this is really politically incredibly contentious these days. Here are all these cities walled around and labelled Levites, and here is hostile territory. And so even books of that age are a bit difficult to shift. But I thought I'd chuck out everything that was over a million in Amazon's best-selling list, because surely if it's over a million, you can't sell it. And the very next day I sold a book called Fishing Dogs, which was over 2 million. So I've kept these, what I look at and think, does anyone in the whole wide world still want this? I've got half a room still dedicated to my old stock, but they will go out and we'll get the room back sometime. I miss the shop. I really miss the customers. The great thing about bookshops and secondhand bookshops is talking to people who are really into their subject and know everything there is and more than you will ever know about it, and picking up the odd stray act or two. I really miss that. These days, the sort of tremendous experience that used to happen when people would come around and say, if you've got such and such a book, I will go on my knees to you. And you go into your back shop and you pick it out and say, how about this? And they say, I have been looking for that book for 16 years. It doesn't happen. You can look for it on the internet. So the thrill of anticipation has gone from a book collector. He may have a load more books. But some people regret the thrill of the chase. There was a couple who were looking for Mr. Punch, the whole 1920s. Mr. Punch goes to the city, Mr. Punch at the theatre, Mr. Punch on the links, and they said, we've just got five missing, and I didn't have any Mr. Punches that they hadn't got. And I said, okay, I'll go on the internet and find the five, because they were in their 80s and were not terribly net literate. I'm bad enough in my 70s. I still don't know some of the things I could do if I could discover how to. And said, oh no, it takes the fun away. Don't do it. So there are still enough, there are still a few people like that, but they're not enough to keep your old-fashioned second-hand bookshop going. But I've got friends in the trade who will be watching me online, and who, some of them hope keep going, some have packed up, some have gone online, some have retired.
So how does it feel finally then to be down here on Trafalgar Square, about to step foot on that, on the plinth as part of the One Another project?
Well, gabbing along to you has helped calm my nerves slightly. I'm frightened, but I think it'll be great fun once I get over the initial nerves. I hope so. Have you had anyone who's actually fainted yet?
No.
Well, there you are then. You wouldn't tell me if you had, would you?
No. Thank you very much.
Okay, I hope you can do something with that load of free association.